Okay, so the cinema and Hollywood, and what a perfect way to actually come back after the Academy Awards to prep the way for a number of key things. But also tap in, as far as public relations is concerned, to FANG, or Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Very much at the rear end, or contemporary end, of communicating in society. And also the huge package that works with the whole essence of PR. Certainly you could argue that when Edward Bernays first started realizing of the power of celebrity endorsement, that the visual image, the celebrity endorsement that you get within Hollywood and that whole package is deeply embedded and rooted in the whole essence of what public relations has been and is and probably will be. So it ties into that area. And what I'll be approaching over the next 45 to 50 minutes are a key number of sort of steps historically, and also, as I've just given you hard copies of a recent article from the BBC Newsbeat system, the contemporary version of how film as a medium may not actually be dying. We talk about one of the essay titles being the blockbuster is coming to the end of its reign. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe there are ways in which things are evolving and changing from that point of view onwards. So, we'll talk about some of the historical aspects of Hollywood. We'll talk about this thing called the blockbuster syndrome. And again, a reminder, the blockbuster is called a blockbuster because in America, groups of houses are referred to as blocks. If you have a cinema, it's actually placed in one of those blocks, you queue around the block, it's a blockbuster. That's the actual origin of how blockbuster became a term. People would actually queue up extensively to actually see the movie and so on. And this thing, it's sometimes been referred to as the tentpole movie, the movie that actually sort of is a real success financially and so on. And also we go on to consider how marketing, branding, digitization, diversification all tie into this one of my independent study tutees. They're focusing on the branding techniques being employed by the Marvel Comics universe, how over 22 Marvel movies, they've effectively sort of managed to tick every box when it comes to obviously success in getting the product out and really sort of addressing that whole factor as well. So we'll talk a bit about that, and again, hopefully also float a couple of sort of key things to maybe talk about, given that obviously on Thursday, you'll be doing your individual presentations. I'll be asking you to maybe have a look at question three in terms of this little aspect relating to the whole essence of local cinemas, where the cinema actually operates, and is it becoming a bit like going to the opera, where it becomes a kind of an event in itself and something that should be seen as special, or is not Netflix taking over the whole globe? So let's dial back a little bit, not too far, not as way back certainly as the essence of the origins of cinema, which kind of started at the beginning of the 20th century, but more to the perspective of how cinema at this stage, by the 1940s, was very much in its heyday. People would go to the cinema. There were actually, you know, figures that we can look at which suggest that over half the population would go to the cinema on a weekly basis to actually see the movies, to see the talkies. Colour, of course, sound, all the great sort of things we take for granted nowadays, very much innovative in those days. The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, gangster movies, genre movies, all of these things were being developed to kind of produce something which would be appealing. Kind of the greatest show on earth, a term that P.T. Barnum coined. And are still used to actually define and outline what the Academy Awards are actually about. The greatest show on earth. Hollywood, if nothing else, has never been known to reduce its hyperbole. Okay. Cinema has always been told it's dying. Pretty much from the advent of radio, from the advent of television, from the advent of social media, it's dead. Nobody goes to the cinema. Why would we bother? And Hollywood in particular has kind of suffered over the years because of a number of key areas that were seen as being problematic. Hollywood was established by a whole group of emigrants and immigrants of the United States, people who would often transfer across the Atlantic from either Western Europe and fleeing from the threat of Nazism and the Nazi Party in Germany, or communism in Russia, or various other sort of systems, or they wanted to simply actually start all over again. And you find that actually an awful lot of cinema directors, Fritz Lang, and even Alfred Hitchcock, who was a British director, of course, went over to Hollywood and made his fortune over there, were very much kind of people who were coming in from outside, from externally, and so on. But this also begs the question, what about Europe's own industry? It's often said that one of the reasons that Britain has never really had a hugely thriving film industry is because we share the same language as America. So actually you don't have to worry about subtitles in terms of people seeing different programmes at different times and so on. Whereas France in particular had a very well developed film industry, likewise Germany, Spain as well. And they still maintained that sort of aspect. Interestingly, France, after the Second World War, fell very much in love with Hollywood because they've been starved of Hollywood product. They hadn't seen any Hollywood movies for 6 or 7 years due to the Second World War. So an awful lot of people would actually watch a whole range of westerns and romance films and musicals and a whole variety of other aspects relating to the movie industry, and would start detecting various other things. You'd get a whole range of people who would be developing magazines like Cahiers du Cinéma, which would be a film critics magazine, which would develop the whole sort of aspect. Also, when the cinema first started, it was really meant for people living in cities. You went to the pictures or the movies because it was round the corner from where you were. And clearly, if you're actually moving out because you're more affluent and you're leaving the inner cities and so on, and you're moving to suburban environments, and it was more of a chore to kind of travel into the city to actually see the movie and so on. It's interesting, of course, that's changed these days because an awful lot of cinemas have kind of moved out as well in terms of you actually get them set up in a variety of other aspects. And also in 1948, an arrangement which had worked very well for the first half century of Hollywood, in which the movie studios effectively had a deal with the exhibitors and the distributors in terms of when the particular cinema chains could actually show their movies, that was actually deemed to be illegal. It was seen as a monopoly. That actually Warner Brothers or Paramount or Columbia effectively owning the areas that they were distributed into was like, it's like you write the book, you own the book, you own the rights to the book, and you own basically who can actually sell the book as well. So these were all sort of areas which were being discovered in terms of how problematic cinema was actually seen. But as we've said, this wonderful populist movement, the movement that effectively has revolutionised the sort of views of our love for stories, our appreciation of narrative, etc., and of course concession stands, still continued. Despite in the 1950s, of course, this little product that came in. Why would people go to the cinema if you could actually see movies in your own home? Well, one of the things that cinema would counter with was actually screen size, and also colour, and also things like 3D. The first 3D pictures were first developed in the 1950s, and kind of came back every 20 or so years after that. 3D's kind of become or real 3D has become a kind of an impacted thing there. Some people still don't like 3D, so it gives them a headache. Some people still prefer a 3D experience. Some people can't, you know, it's a whole variety of ways. But they're all put into place to, again, compete, and those are innovations. So cinema doesn't simply react by saying, we're not going to do anything. They're still producing material that actually gets people's attention. They get the widescreen. They get 3D. They get Technicolor. Things which certainly in the 50s and arguably even in the 60s with the advent of colour television, and we'll talk about television next week, weren't really easily accessible for your average middle-class family. And certainly not for your lower middle-class family, or your working-class family, or whomever. We talked about blockbusters. It's often said that this remake of Cecil B. DeMille's silent movie, The Ten Commandments, in the 1920s, was the first contemporary blockbuster in 1956. And you might well say $43 million is not a great deal to actually spend on a movie in terms of taking through that. But the idea is this is something where kind of many of the key things that we now tend to view as natural aspects in terms of movies are put in place. The star system is actually there. The big biblical epic, the Charlton Heston of the world, the whole essence of dramatic sort of impacts and so on and so forth. And again, the use of hyperbole. Paramount Pictures presents the greatest epic of all, Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments and so on. It's also tapping very much into something which also has gone hand in hand with Hollywood and the movie industry, which is a code of morals, a code of ethics. Specifically in Hollywood, there was the Hays Code, H-A-Y-S, which was in place pretty much from the late 20s to really the late 60s, in which certain things were allowed on screen and certain things were definitely forbidden. One of those things, for instance, was you could never actually have two individuals of the same gender or sex actually in a bedroom together. Absolutely out of the question. Too suggestive. If you actually had a heterosexual couple in a bedroom scene, you always had to ensure that at least one of them actually was seated and the other one was in bed and so on. So there were certain sort of constraints that were very much in place there. So Hollywood kind of reacted by using a lot of visual shorthands, such as trains going into tunnels, such as waves washing up on the seashore, which would be sort of cutaways and so on. All of these kind of related to the sort of challenges that the industry was actually faced with. And certainly when you're actually branding particular products, whether they are movie musicals, whether they are James Bond movies, whether they are horror movies, whatever your particular aspect tends to be, they'll feed into a whole range of other aspects. And the last three things were mentioned deliberately, James Bond, Hammer Horror, other sort of issues related to that, because the cinema was very much targeted in the 50s and 60s as being for people in their teens and early 20s. It was a place you went to as a date option. It was a place that you'd actually go to as a drive-in movie. You might not sort of actually have the sort of movie in mind. You know, it's again looking to reach that sort of youth market. Why? Because obviously running parallel to this, you've got things like the growth of rock and roll. Elvis Presley, Bill Haley, the whole sort of aspects of seeing your idols on the screen and so on can also tap into place with that. Musicals as well can be very positive. The drive-in movie, it's never really taken off in Britain, probably because of the weather, and also because it tends to be used as event cinemas. I don't know if anybody has anybody been to one of the event cinema things with Back to the Future or Alien or any of the things where there's a full event at all? No? Oh, well worth seeing. But you also see a whole range of exploitation movies, things like I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. I Was a Teenage Werewolf. In the 70s, of course, the movies like Grease would also be sort of echoed in terms of that whole sort of aspect, which again, you sort of work through that. And that areas which again sort of open that, the whole notions of the rise of the Brat Pack in the 70s, 80s and 90s would also sort of echo the whole notion of the teenage picture. People that you could identify with and work through. And because obviously when you're at university, you want to actually sort of have more refined tastes, or maybe you're looking to develop and refine your taste. Maybe you might even go and see some movies which actually had subtitles, movies which effectively had, you know, more exotic sort of aspects. Fellini's 8.5, for instance, the notion of art cinema, cultural cinema. Lots of sort of area there that kind of opens up the discussion of where movies are coming from. And as I mentioned, because the French kind of led the way in this, and then it percolated through a whole range of things to the extent that these days very few universities don't have film studies courses, that whole notion of the more you learn about a particular topic, the more interested you are in terms of it, finding out more about stuff, and therefore there's almost a market to go and see additional material which talks you through the sort of cultural aspects of cinema. I mean, cinema is great for providing you with a cultural snapshot of things at the time. Even viewed through a 21st century perspective, you look at something like, let's take the thing you were talking about earlier, Green Book, the tale of two real-life characters, one of whom effectively is hired as the chauffeur to guide a fairly famous jazz musician through a whole range of Deep South American venues, and protect him, basically, because he's a black musician in an era where, basically, there's an awful lot of hatred and concern in America about racial issues and so on. And the movie itself, actually, Becky, I overheard you say, how did it win? Well, it won because it ticked all the right boxes. It ticked the box which basically said it was racially aware, it had a happy ending, a very schmaltzy ending, admittedly, in terms of the way in which it all ends up at Christmas and all is happy at the end.
So, like Driving Miss Daisy and like The Help, both won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Don't get me wrong, I do love The Help. But it's a white savior movie, that's why it won. That's very much why it won in Hollywood. That is very much why it won. Green Book should. Even the man that it's about, his family was like, that's not what happened.
Technically, he didn't say.
You know what? I can't do the. I'm making a heated argument, let's stop.
Technically.
Green Book.
Technically.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah.
Just to actually sort of address one of the flaws in your argument there, Becky, the gentleman who actually it was about actually couldn't make that comment because he actually died 2 years ago. His family actually said that there was a problem. However, the fact of the matter is, it won. Deal with it. It's a way of actually sort of again addressing. And often you do find with respect to Academy Awards, and we'll come to this in a few moments, does the best movie actually win? Mm-hmm. Arguably no. Was Titanic the best movie when it won?
Shape of Water was the stupidest movie I've ever seen, and somehow that won a million Oscars.
I never understand the Oscars.
Have you seen The Shape of Water?
No, because my mum...
She has sex with a fish.
Should we take a commercial break, Becky, once we give you a chance to bet?
Oh my god, we should.
Okay.
But they're all really weird films. Yeah, they are. They're never like a film that like normal person would
watch.
They're all really.
Okay, let's just take a slack, because there was a suggestion this year that was thrown out, unfortunately. Two suggestions, actually. One, that would there be a new category that would be introduced to the Academy Awards, which would be most popular movie. And that was actually rejected in the end because people said, well, surely. They're all popular movies up for fashion. And the second one, of course, was to actually only deliver some of the awards during the actual live transmitted piece, and the others to actually be running commercials.
Yeah, I remember that. Everyone went mad. Everyone went mad on Twitter, and I was like, oh, okay.
I got put in like a group chat
when
people were like, sign this petition.
Yeah.
An old film group chat, and I was there like, why?
Anyway, suffice it to say, what we have actually just proved is that there's still a range of passionate views being put forward in terms of movies and so on. Back to blockbusters in the 1960s, Rodgers and Hammerstein very much ruling the roost with respect to The Sound of Music. This was very much the same team that brought you South Pacific, that had brought you Oklahoma, that had brought you Carousel, and so on. And again, you've got pretty much everything that you actually need in terms of the ultimate feel-good sort of factor. You've got religious background, you've got Nazis, you've got nuns, you've got shepherds, you've got a whole range of other sort of elements within that whole field. And of course the sing-along version, which continues to do very well even today. However, Hollywood gambles. You might have thought on the back of The Sound of Music and all of the musicals, a musical is guaranteed to have lots of success. I mean, the latest musical has been prepped as being an absolutely outstanding one is Jamie. The whole range of sort of elements there, but there are lots of examples of major flops. And in the words of Samuel Goldwyn, the only thing you can guarantee about the film industry is that nobody knows nothing about anything. And I think you've got a problem that's obviously part and parcel of this whole notion in terms of how do you actually legitimise what is going to succeed and so on. Dr. Doolittle, not the Eddie Murphy version that was there, this was a musical starring Rex Harrison, in 1967. Likewise, Hello Dolly, Barbara Streisand, Michael Crawford, and so on. And indeed, Star, which again, you could still find, you still access the whole thing. But they weren't major successes. Okay, time to go interactive. Can you tell me the first names of those four directors, please?
Roman Polanski.
Starting, Roman Polanski is correct. That's
Stanley.
What one?
Yeah,
Stanley Kubrick. Federico Fellini, well done. Looking very like Donald Sutherland, actually. And
Stanley.
Yes, Kubrick and Truffaut.
The top one.
We know the two on the right.
True. He was also in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. François Truffaut. French, Polish, American, Italian.
That's the American, okay.
All leading in their own way to a new wave of cinematic audiences. A new wave who are educated, who are fairly youthful, fairly politically aware, very much in favour of the growing civil rights movement. And this again, in terms of, BBC refer to it as diversification, how you actually see a whole range of elements, whether you're referring to BAME, whether you're referring to transgender issues and so on, all fit into this whole notion of how individuals are being represented on screen. And certainly, given Vietnam was very much at its height in this particular era, lots of movies were taking a very strong anti-war message. There were one or two notable pro-war messages as well, Green Berets being one of the things which springs to mind immediately relating to that, and also the whole notion of the sexual revolution. The advent of the pill, the notion of a whole range of sort of aspects working through that, all of those five elements leads to a change in terms of what traditional cinema is about, how it kind of reflects its audiences, and maybe actually paves the way for saying, well, you know, why is it that we see the Academy Awards and we don't relate to Green Book or Shape of Water or The Artist or any of the other sort of elements which are there? Well, they're all created by filmmakers like Truffaut, arguably like Spielberg, although again Spielberg's been accused in various ways of being a populist. Not there's anything wrong with that. I mean, if you're a populist, it means you're making material which is simply very reflective of a particular era in time. Sexual explicit, again, it's one of those aspects which is continuing to grow. Those of you who may have been to see The Aftermath, it was interesting, I was watching it on Saturday. There were a couple of people who were sitting in the back of the cinema who, when they saw the warning from the British Board of Film Classification, said, oh, sexual, I'm not sure about this, I don't think there'll be any sex in it. Great, fair enough. Graphically violent, again, issues relating to sort of areas within that. And certainly the British Board of Film Classification, just as the American Screen Classification, will provide the audience with some indication in terms of whether a movie is U, suitable for all, 12A, accompanied by an adult, 15, 18, so on and so forth.
Was this when films like Clockwork Orange came?
Yeah, Clockwork Orange is late 1970s. That explains so much, Becky, it says. Okay, The Godfather, probably one of those perfect examples of a movie which was very much tapping into the notion of the gangster genre. And the Godfather trilogy, often hailed as being an absolute masterpiece, Godfather 1 and 2 and so on. It's a story that, in many ways, you could say, was re-echoed in television terms by the work of James Gandolfini and I forgot the name, Mafia, very famous Mafia series. No?
What are we talking about?
TV series which I think had its roots in The Godfather. It was a very famous Mafia series.
The Sopranos.
The Sopranos, thank you.
Oh, that's actually right. Okay.
Which again also shows and demonstrates quite clearly how things like television will feed from film and vice versa. You get the movie, which is the film or the book, you get the TV series, you get the spin-off, you get a range of other elements. The latter part of the 20th century, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a complete flop as a movie, but as a TV series, it worked extremely well. So again, that's a way forward in terms of what sort of things we're seeing in that particular aspect. And it all relates to this virtuous circle. And where you would sit in terms of, obviously, if you're working in public relations, do you work for the publishing company or do you work for the movie company? Because that whole circle there that you can see demonstrated in terms of movie hype illustrates the notion of how a book does very well, Harry Potter, leads to interest in the film, leads to more interest in the book. 50 Shades of Grey, film, disaster, book, and so on. And it becomes part and parcel of that whole sort of
package. And then people are always like, oh, is the book better than the film? What one's better? And then some people read, I know some people that go and read books because they've seen films and people tell them that the book's better.
I originally, the Harry Potter films, I watched the films, then I read the books, and then I watched the films again.
So you've actually lived that
I
actual
read the books and then sat throughout all the films like, this is incorrect. You are wrong.
And you probably verbalised you probably verbalised that through the cinema, pointing that out to people quite at the same time.
Actually, no, I'm a very quiet person.
Okay. So, question. How does something like Jaws, which again is often regarded as a huge blockbuster, and certainly Steven Spielberg's major opening in terms of this, relate to that? Well, terrifying motion picture from the terrifying number one bestseller. You know, the whole aspect of this very basic sort of line, 2 years before Star Wars hit in 1977, and it kind of launches that whole notion of people becoming an event that people want to actually go and see and address and so on. It taps into horror, it taps into culture and so on. As indeed Thomas Schatz actually says with this little quote, which is well worth considering from the point of view of how this is really using cinema as not so much a kind of cultural art form, but something which is very much at the centre of our expectations in society and so on. Okay, so, into the 70s, parents' generation, even younger, less political, more conservative with a small c, but again, obviously, with spending power. I mean, going to the cinema is relatively inexpensive in comparative terms. I mean, I realise it depends on where you're going. So I don't think the Odeon does its student audience any huge favours, but in terms of, in most cases, you can get lots of deals and packages to ensure that you can escape, because movies are about escapism at one level. You can actually escape into a different narrative, a different universe, a different dream, and so on. It might be a comedy, it might be a romance, it might be a combination of all sorts of things, etc. But clearly it's all, from the industry point of view, designed to ensure it's another opportunity to ensure that audiences will part with their pennies and actually sort of say, okay, let's go and see this. And merchandising also is part and parcel of this. You know, the whole notion that Disney probably first tapped into and then was developed further, and obviously still continues to be, about don't just see the movie, buy the book, get the posters, get the t-shirts, get all the other sort of aspects. So it all taps into that whole particular area. And so we also see, certainly with the advent of Star Wars, pretty much to the present day, a lot of shift in terms of what we see in blockbusters. They become more speedy, they become more reliant on special effects. Anybody who's actually seen Alita Battle Angel will again see that that is very much written from the basis of James Cameron, the natural progression that you get where the lead, Alita, is completely CGI. And apart from the eyes, maybe, you wouldn't actually be able to sort of really recognise that because it's fitted in very much to the narrative. It's a very basic plot. It's usually the sort of standard line from that point of view. And also, these things tend to be much more fantasy-oriented. Lord of the Rings, the whole trilogy. The elements that relate to, obviously, the Marvel Universe, the DC Universe, and so on. Characters themselves, you could argue, tend to actually become more functional within the narrative rather than actually narratives emerging from characters. Again, these are broad, sweeping strokes. Are they one-dimensional? Well, is James Bond one-dimensional? Possibly. Are they more heroic? How do we actually see things being developed from that point of view as well? What tends to happen then is what we can refer to as almost postmodernism. You mix up the genres, you have knowing cinematic references, you can go and see Ready Player One and play spot the cultural reference to all the various characters that have emerged from all the other movies that you've actually seen and so on. And you can almost say you get a kind of pastiche. So actually there's no such thing as an original form and so on. Which is exactly where Netflix will actually start borrowing from all these kind of tropes and start developing various other factors. Q, the next little aspect I want to come towards, which, curiously enough, actually fits into a little under 5 minutes in terms of length, and it's this whole notion of Netflix responding to Oscars and Steven Spielberg quotes, etc. It actually lasts for 5 minutes, well, actually 4 minutes, 32 seconds, and could be used as the ideal template to get a score of 95%, or thereabouts, on the presentations on Thursday, if you were doing something relating to movies. Here it comes.
Netflix is revolutionising the way we watch TV, but some fear that Netflix could be closing the curtains on the big screen. So, is there any evidence to suggest that our love for streaming movies at home could spell the end for cinema? US-based company Netflix has had more than a few reasons to celebrate this year. It's added a record-breaking number of paid users to its online streaming service in 2018, now topping 139 million worldwide. That's three times the number of accounts just 5 years ago. Keep in mind that more than one person could be using an account, so its reach is even bigger. The USA is Netflix's top market globally, with over 40% of all paid users based there. The company has also invested heavily into producing original content, including big movie blockbusters. Analysts estimate that the company spent $13 billion on titles like Narcos and Bird Box in 2018. That would be enough to make Titanic, one of the most expensive films ever made, 65 times. Its efforts seem to be paying off. This year, its critically acclaimed film Roma has earned the streaming service its first Best Picture Oscar nomination, with 10 in total. You might think that can only benefit the box office, but Netflix has been criticised for showing films in a relatively small number of movie theatres and for a limited time before streaming them on its own site. So, are there any signs that cinemas are suffering? Not really. While analysts said that 2017 was a tough year for movie makers, last year saw a boost for the box office. Worldwide, cinemas made over $41.5 billion. That's 2.6% more than in 2017. The top three markets, the USA, China, and the UK, all saw increases in revenues too. And moviegoers in America generated nearly $12 billion for the industry. There are other reasons to be skeptical of the suggestions that the rising popularity of Netflix is to blame for the perceived decline of cinema. Comparing the trends in cinema revenues and streaming services tells us little about how one impacts the other. Just like the consumption of mozzarella cheese can't really explain the rise in the number of civil engineering doctorates awarded, even though they're both going up. There are a number of other factors at play, which are likely to contribute to the possible success or failure of cinemas and streaming services. But is there any evidence to suggest that Netflix and movie theatres are competing for audiences? That's a tricky one too. One US study by NATO, that's the National Association of Theatre Owners in the States, not the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, surveyed just under 2,000 people in the US who both streamed content and saw at least one film in the cinema over the last year. They found that people who watch a lot of stream programs also go to the cinema frequently, while those who don't subscribe rarely visit the movie theater either. But even that doesn't tell us conclusively about how the use of one platform actually affects people's cinema habits. Remember, it was thought that bringing televisions into homes in the 1950s could kill off Hollywood too. And like TV and cinemas, streaming services such as Netflix face a few challenges of their own. Netflix uses debt to finance its spending on content and has said it will raise prices in the USA and in Latin America as it needs to make more cash. The cheapest plan will now be $3.99 a month. That's about the same price for seeing a movie at a cinema, with a ticket costing $8.97 in the US. Could that make streamers switch off? The company will also see stiff competition, not just from the likes of Amazon, which has picked up a few awards of its own, but also Disney Plus. Disney's streaming service is due to launch in late 2019. That will strip Netflix of several popular Disney-owned shows on its platform. Either way, cinema lovers need not panic, for now. the battle for viewers' eyeballs and their cash is just heating up.
So there we are, and within the 10% line of 5 minutes as well. Perfect.
Netflix is revolutionising the way we watch TV, but...
Okay. Or 10 minutes, of course, in your own case, Becky. So, recent developments, as we said, marketing, branding, clearly the fact that Disney is also expanding this Disney Plus market, looking to open up Amazon, we mentioned as well from that point of view. It all depends how we're consuming these movies. The overall trend seems to be, emphasize seems to be, on the up, but we're just around the corner from obviously having to have a new marketing package and so on. And whether you're looking at these 80s classics, exactly, as we said, which you probably have a live-action version in the works already. The remakes of Total Recall, Philip K. Dick's novel, featuring Schwarzenegger and others. And indeed, the remake... Does anybody know what the remake of Pretty Woman, or what Pretty Woman was originally based on?
Such a stupid movie. Never seen that.
Anybody know what it was based on?
No.
Book by George Bernard Shaw?
I know that name, but I just know it was like a standard.
No, no. It was based actually by George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which itself had a...
So you've mentioned it before. I'm pretty sure you have.
I might well have done in a previous life. And in addition to that, it was also remade in the 1960s as My Fair Lady.
Oh, no, that's what you mentioned was... Pygmalion, it was that one.
And Pretty Woman basically updates for the 90s, My Fair Lady / Pygmalion, which is again worth accessing and so on. Advertising continues to grow in terms of cinema, and obviously substantially more since I took that 2005 figure together. And the whole essence of media convergence is very much at the height here. Something we'll talk about in a few weeks' time again, this whole notion of how media impacts on particular events. And so on. And so if we actually go back to the original question that we put in your essay titles, which I just go back to essays under assessments here, which I think is question 6, is the time of the blockbuster over? How can cinema survive? Well, what I've attempted to spend the last 40 minutes or so doing is saying, well, maybe that notion, the very simplistic view that, yeah, blockbusters, they're not going to occur, cinema's going to be dying, it's not going to be around for much longer. Maybe it is actually bucking the trends through some of the things we've talked about. Why does Steven Spielberg get so concerned in terms of his backlash against Netflix? Well, it's all about how you consume your movies, as we said. Is it on your tablet? Is it on your mobile phone screen? Is there something special about seeing it in the cinema? Is that worth paying for? How does it connect together from that point of view? Again, questions that need to be considered and discussed, etc. So, in terms of the conclusion from this point of view, let's consider...
How many words is the essay?
1,500 words. What if marketers develop scripts around products? Ooh, product placement. Maybe it's already occurring. Maybe we're seeing that as a matter of course. Or whether you're dealing with fizzy drinks or other sort of elements that are feeding with that. What about another sort of months of marketing and PR preceding a film? Does that actually help? We see the posters, we see the buzz, we see the words, we see the interviews, we see the release, we see the San Diego Comic Cons, we see all of the kind of aspects which kind of generate the hype and the excitement, which basically means you're blocking areas ahead, not just months, but years in terms of the planning. And maybe we're also getting this whole notion of actually... We talk about movies. Well, actually, America is a foreign culture. Maybe this whole notion that post-Brexit we're going to have chlorinated food and all sorts of other problems to take on board from the food American situation, maybe that'll all be sorted out for us by the point of view of American Hollywood cultures and so on. Again, that's certainly a big concern in terms of overseas cinema and so on. Or maybe Netflix is a reverse to that. Because the one great thing about Netflix and even Amazon Prime is you can see foreign or country, other countries' television shows and indeed filmic products, the notion of Scandinavian crime dramas being one of those key things that sort of sprung to mind in terms of popularity and so on. One of the elements about digitisation is that the whole experience is much better. The sound quality is better. It's Dolby Stereo. It's designed to actually give you the sense of being there. It's designed to be a sense experience that you can get with a home cinema, or it's much more a spectacle where you're actually in the middle of the action. You actually have this epic experience that kind of is designed to actually give you that digital line, which under analog film certainly was not really feasible. And it's interesting that at the end of the last century, screenwriter Terry Fleur actually sort of noted that 13 of the top 20 global top grossing films of all time, especially effects driven, now we're looking at much higher numbers. We're looking at pretty much 17 out of every 20 are being effects driven and so on. Does anybody have any questions about the notion of cinema and Hollywood and the developments of that, or indeed your... Oops. Presentations on Thursday, which hopefully, apart from obviously Emma's, we'll all be sort of working through. Or would you all just like to sign the register and say, hello? No? Okay, the only other thing I wanted to actually point out is...